Welcome to the Ludwig Erhard Memorial Lecture, which is sponsored by the LSE's Center for Economic Performance and the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung. This occasion is in celebration of the 100th birthday of the founder of the German social market economy model, Ludwig Erhard. It is not actually his birthday today. I must apologize, we're a little late celebrating this event. Our speaker, Professor Vattring, has spent most of his academic career at the University of Cologne. He did his doctorate there, and after a brief period at the University of Bochum, became professor in the Department of Economics and Social Sciences in 1971. He has many academic distinctions. He has, for example, been the visiting Adenauer Professor at Georgetown University from 1986 to 1987, and immediately after that, he became a member of the Academic Advisory Council to the Federal Ministry of Economic Affairs, which he was chairman of that from 1987 to 1992. His topic this evening is the German social market economy, experiences and limits. Professor Vattring.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honor for me to have been asked to give a lecture at this most prestigious London School of Economics, an institution which I know since my early studies at the University of Cologne in the 50s. Let me start with a few remarks before presenting the substance of the German market economy. I would like to make a few remarks about Ludwig Erhard, who was born on the 4th of February 1897 in Fürth, a small German town where his parents ran a retail shop. This day, when he was born, witnessed a catastrophic ruling from the German Reichsgericht, that's the Supreme Court. Here a ruling was passed according to which cartels became lawful and could not be sued with respect to restraints of competition. This, of course, was a major setback for the free society. This odd court decision was one of the main reasons why Germany later, especially in the 20s and 30s, became the country of cartels with all the bad economic and political repercussions of such a competitive restraint. 60 years after this ruling, Erhard fought a bitter fight with German industrialists and functionaries of big businesses when introducing an anti-cartel law in Germany and in the German parliament. He was then the Minister of Economics. He succeeded in the first paragraph of that more than 100 paragraph long act by decreeing a ban against restraints of competition in principle. But in the following paragraphs, many exceptions were entered, so that the final outcome was a political compromise giving much leeway to various interest groups for their strategies to close markets and restrict competition. Nevertheless, some defenders of a strict competition policy joked that the avenger of cartels, Ludwig Erhard, was born exactly on the same date when the German High Court dismantled a central piece of liberal economic philosophy. Of course, Erhard himself did not know what important role he would play in German politics. Prior to that time, he was a soldier in the First World War, badly wounded as an artilleryman. He suffered his whole life from a shattered shoulder and feet, which explains his rather peculiar way of walking, and you see him on TV. He studied economics at the Commercial College of Nuremberg, earned a doctor's degree and worked as a research assistant and later as a research director in a small marketing institute. In 1944, during the Second World War, he produced a secret report on Germany's economic policy after the war, which he presented to Dr. Gerdeler. Gerdeler was one of the leading figures of German resistance against Hitler. And after the unsuccessful plot of Colonel Stauffenberg, he was murdered by the Nazi government. Shortly after the Second World War, Erhard was picked by American officers to become the Bavarian Minister of Economic Affairs. And a few months before the German monetary reform in 1948 came into practice, he was elected as head of the German Bayesun Economic Administration, an administration which was under military government at that time. In this position, he produced his first political masterstroke by abolishing many price regulations immediately after the new money was handed out to the West Germans on the 20th of June 1948. His main argument for this dismantling of price control was his conviction that the new paper money would only be trusted if it was backed by goods in the previously totally empty shops. And his calculation proved to be correct. Within days, goods, which in the years before were only available on black markets, could be bought in the shops, and the wealth-creating power of a market economy began to flourish. What was later named the German economic miracle had begun. In 1949, 1 year or 14 months later, when the Federal Republic of Germany was founded, Erhard joined the Christian Democratic Party, the CDU. He served as Minister of Economic Affairs for 14 years under Chancellor Adenauer, building up the economic order in Germany. Under his supervision, numerous important acts were passed in the West German Parliament, liberating the German economy from the countless administrative regulations of the old command economy. Numerous obstacles to international trade were scrapped. The convertibility of the German mark was introduced very early in 1958, and a formerly autarkic country was formed into an open economy. Exceptional growth brought the war-ridden German economy on the road to prosperity. As Tony Nichols demonstrates in his book, Freedom with Responsibility, the Social Market Economy in Germany, 1980 to 1963, the economic reforms had to be pushed through against well-organized and hard-fighting interest group. Erhard was the man at the helm with the great imagination and a strong political vision, fought numerous political battles to reintroduce the reformed market economy, the so-called social market economy or social market system. Despite his great political successes, he was not often backed by Konrad Adenauer, who at the same time was the German Chancellor. In 1963, Erhard followed Konrad Adenauer by becoming the second Chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany. His 3 years as Chancellor were not a success story. He left politics in 1966 in a resigned and depleted state of mind. He died in 1977. At the 100th anniversary of his birthday, the German government celebrated him as one of the legendary founding fathers of a better Germany. But among the guests, however, were some who stepped in 30 years before, not physically but politically. But it is not my intention to tell you further details of the Erhard story. My topic today is the German model of a social market economy. Sometimes it is said that this term was only a slogan by Erhard and others in political debates. It is my intention to show you that a social market economy, according to the German understanding, is more than a political program for the restructuring of a war-devastated economy. The social market economy is a conception of political economy which grew out of German liberal and social philosophy. Its roots go back to the great controversies in the 19th century. Then Gustav von Schmoller, a German social reformer, accused the author of The Theory of Moral Sentiments, Adam Smith, and the classical economist that they did not take notice in their teachings of the economic situation of the working classes and the poor. Schmoller was also a founder of the German Verein für Sozialpolitik, which was founded in 1871. This was an academic, still existing academic association for furthering social policy. This society influenced Bismarck greatly when he started his patriarchalistic policy of the social state in 1878. The German social state, or more understandable perhaps for an English audience, welfare state, was the model which in the first 60 years of the 20th century was imitated in some Western countries. This state form is now in a deep financial crisis, not only in Germany, but throughout Europe. My intention is to demonstrate that the social market economy is a political economy conception, which is primarily liberal in the classical sense of the 18th century Scottish tradition. It is not a model belonging to the social democratic tradition on the continent. On the contrary, German social democrats attacked it heavily for decades. Only recently they started to use the term by giving it an interpretation which is in line with their general interventionist thinking. I'll start with a short explanation of the social philosophical background of the social market economy, and then I will present its main ideas and finally wrap up with some remarks about its influence on German economic policy. First, the historical background. One of the main outcomes of the European miracle, as it was described in the book by Eric L. Jones, is the development of a liberal social philosophy beginning in the 17th and 18th century and lasting until today. The Scottish school of moral philosophy, the liberal classical economics from Adam Smith onwards to John Stuart Mill, as well as the French Jean Baptiste and German thinkers of the late 18th and early 19th century, Immanuel Kant, Friedrich von Schiller, Wilhelm von Humboldt, laid the foundations of a free society. After the European catastrophe, the two world wars, and the establishment of totalitarian and authoritarian regimes in Western and Eastern Europe, an unexpected renaissance of liberal thinking began. It was first led by a small group of lawyers, economists, and social philosophers in the Western world, and its early origins can be traced back into the 30s and 40s of our century. It is to be hoped that this philosophy will also spread following the Annus Mirabilis 1989 East and Middle Europe, and that among the 20th century scholars who further developed the ideas of a free or a good society, one could name, for instance, the Italian Bresciani Turoni, the Frenchman Bertrand de Jouvenel, the German Walter Eucken, the British, Austrian, American Friedrich A. von Hayek, a teacher from the London School of Economics, Karl Popper, Wilhelm Röpke from Genf, and many others. Despite the fact that they were not a well-organized group and that they did not agree on many details of a liberal order, their common belief was that the answer to the multifarious problems of post-war Europe and the world was the rebuilding of a free society on the foundations laid in previous centuries. After the period of absolutism, political power was transferred from absolutist rule to newly founded parliaments, and under the influence of German legal philosophy, a government of law in German Rechtsstaat was developed, initially in Prussia and later in various other countries. Additionally, the French Revolution spurred the abolition of most economic regulations in the old society, and the idea of liberty under the law was born, and Hayek emphasizes this in his monumental Constitution of Liberty with the words, quote, "Mankind had learned from a long and painful experience." The central questions to be faced by the liberal writers in the first half of the 20th century were, why did the young free society, which evolved during the 19th century, enter a destructive period of warring instead of developing into an even greater open society? And at the end of the 19th century, why did imperialism and aggressive nationalism, movements which were one of the causes of the World War, sweep Europe? And after the terrible killings, what hampered the return to a peaceful order? How could it occur that authoritarian and, in the German case, totalitarian movements took over, drawing most of Europe into a second, even more devastating war, which in the end brought Stalin's troops into the center of Europe, suppressing Eastern and Middle European states previously known for a history of political and economic freedom? European scholars were faced with real problems. But for a vast majority of intellectuals, at least in the mild form of the British Scandinavian model of the welfare state, the order of the day was not personal freedom in the classical sense. If there were to be a chance for a free society, convincing arguments had therefore to be presented first as to why historical liberalism, as Repke used to call it, failed, and why the rebuilding of a society of free people was a better solution than a socialist program of bureaucratic management of the economy and, in the end, also of the society. It is not surprising that the debates after the Second World War in Germany encompassed a much broader view point in continental Europe than the Anglo-Saxon world, where under the auspices of a long and stable tradition of democratic rule, mainly the economic aspects of the problem were discussed. The economic problems, as for instance the scope of the laissez-faire rule, that is, the agenda and non-agenda of the state, or using the familiar phrase of John Stuart Mill, the limits of the laissez-faire and non-interference principle. And under the influence of Hayek, Repke, Risto and others, a much broader view was taken in German discussions. The main interdependencies between the subsystems of a free society were discussed, as for instance, the relations between the political, the economic, and the social system, the role of law, of morals, and of citizens' loyalty to a state with clearly restricted powers. Economic freedom was not looked upon as being primarily an instrument to increase the efficiency of markets, but as a value in itself. As Repke once put it, even if socialism should prove to be more efficient in producing goods than a market economy, the latter would be preferable because of the personal freedom it conveys to citizens living under its rule. Economic freedom in a world with open borders would also be a powerful obstacle to despotic rule or a Leviathan state, because citizens would possess an exit option, which is the most efficient response for disagreeing with the policy performance of a country. The end of the totalitarian age came for West Germany after its unconditional surrender in 1945. There was not much dispute that the political order should be re-established along the line of democratic government. freedom of speech, freedom of information, of thought, were undisputed, but not the power to run of the state to run the economy by allocating even the simplest goods via bureaucratic directives. In an essay in the first volume of Ordo, that is from the Latin Ordo, O-R-D-O, the yearbook of the neoliberals, Müller-Armack, one of the architects of the social market economy, opens his remarks on economic orders seen from a social perspective with a very pessimistic outlook. He writes in 1948, quote, "In our times, there is widespread consensus that central planning is the only promising way for the future. Fortunately, West Germany's currency and economic reforms a few months later, igniting the German miracle with high rates of growth for more than 15 years, proved this to be incorrect. The economic policy under which this upswing took place was later named social market economy, and indeed, the measures taken by the legendary Minister of Economic Affairs at that time, Ludwig Erhard, were based on the liberal ideas expounded by the German liberals, as for instance Franz Böhm, von Dietze, Hensel, Fröhlicher Lutz, and others. Not only did Müller-Armack invent the phrase social market economy, he was also the first author to publish a lengthy treatise on that topic in 1946, and later he became a high-ranking public official shaping economic policy. It would be a great misunderstanding to interpret the social market economy as a brand name for a successful economic reform after a devastating war. On the contrary, the founding fathers of this conception intended a restatement of the classical liberal ideas under the prevailing historical circumstances, the end of a totalitarian regime and a country in shambles. Therefore, it must be asked what type of liberalism the social market economy movement represents. The main elements. There are two groups to be taken into account in the German liberal movement during the 40s and 50s. The ordo-liberals, or Freiburg School, as they were called, with their leading figures, Franz Böhm and Walter Eugen, and the proponents of the social market economy, among which Müller-Armack is the most impressive figure. Both schools agreed that a free society cannot be justified with the help of economic efficiency arguments, but, and that is the central idea, only with personal liberty. Therefore, the social market economy was not seen only as a program to rebuild a war-shaken economy, but as a program in the much broader context of liberal philosophy, a program of how to shape the political and economic order, the culture, the press, higher learning, science, and many other topics where freedom is important, I mean personal freedom is important, and where institutions can be shaped according to the essence of liberalism. From this follows that the two groups had to wrestle with socialist collectivism on the one hand and the previous conception of a free society on the other. As far as socialist collectivism is concerned, the arguments are apparent, and I will not discuss them further. The dispute with the older liberalism, sometimes called paleo-liberalism, or laissez-faire capitalism, or historical liberalism, involved the question why the 19th century liberalism failed. The argument leveled against classical liberalism runs as follows. Even though it succeeded in freeing men from the bonds of the pre-industrial society, the elimination of social privileges, together with the introduction of economic freedom and the renunciation of state intervention in private markets, these measures were insufficient to maintain a constitution of liberty. The reason is very simple. Every actor in a market has a strong incentive to monopolize, and if he or she is successful in forming cartels or restrain competition, they can earn higher profits and live a quieter life. This only can be inhibited if, according to the order liberals, a strong state would enforce rules of competition which prevent cartelization. In Germany, as I mentioned before, the opposite was the case. I pointed out the ruling of the Supreme Court of 1897, which permitted cartel agreements as fully legal and fully compatible with the freedom of contract. This meant that they could be enforced by law. During the Great Depression, 1929 to 1936, these cartels reacted to decreasing demand for their goods by keeping prices high and laying off workers. The high unemployment rates were one of the sources with the help of which Hitler was able to gain power. From this and other experiences, Eugenbohm and others concluded that the protection of competition is one of the most important duties of a modern liberal state. According to their view, the failure of the old liberals was in not recognizing that guarding private property rights and enforcing private contracts were insufficient for maintaining a liberal economic order. In their strictures against the gross misinterpretation of the freedom of contract by the Reich Supreme Court, the order liberals pointed out that it leads to the creation of powerful interest groups and a new dependence of workers on their employers, of consumers on monopolists, and of retailers on combines and cartels. The resulting inference of the neoliberal program was, unless a liberal constitutional state is prepared to see itself deteriorating into an interventionist state, as for instance the Weimar Republic, in which economic processes are manipulated to suit political opportunism, the maintenance and enforcement of a competitive system must be one of the prime objectives of a modern liberal state. Going back to the well-known dichotomy, free enterprise versus competition policy, one can say that the auto people were in favor of competition policy. For them, an effective competition policy was one of the pillars of a social market economy. This policy should not be based on discretionary decisions by politicians or bureaucrats, but instead be a part of the legal system, thereby embedding competition policy into the economic order of a free society. The protection and enforcement of workable competition was seen as a piece of creative legislation, or in other words, their approach was rule-oriented or law-making. It was said that the decisions incumbent upon the legislators could not simply be left to a spontaneous balancing of political interest, since the stronger groups which tyrannized the government, as Adam Smith used to say, would otherwise pervert the law to meet their interest. Therefore, the real need was seen as gearing legislation to the common good. It is the rules of the competitive game of the market should be fair for everybody and should leave no room for exceptions favoring single industries or companies. Eugen in particular developed the idea of vollständige Konkurrenz, a term which should not be translated into English as perfect competition. Instead, Eucken's notion implies that restraints on competition should not be legalized and that the real problem lies in safeguarding individual freedom in the markets, introducing fair rules of conduct and suppressing private economic power. The conception of a rule-oriented competition policy also led the ordo-liberals to oppose the ideas of industrial policy by which state bureaucrats steer industrial production according to the idea of protecting losers and subsidizing winners. Further, because of the significance assigned by the ordo-liberals to a well-functioning system of competition as the linchpin of a new liberal economic order, they took a firm stand against the insinuation that such an order represented the interests of capital, as a Marxist used to say. Their counter-argument was that the principle of competition should be adopted to counteract all endeavors by individuals or state attempting to monopolize markets either at home or abroad. In their view, only this stance provided justification for considering their vision of a market economy as acceptable to everyone, from the ultimate producer or consumer to the supplier or user of productive resources. They also believed that a systematically developed competitive market system permitted above all the weakest members of society to lead a life befitting a human being. From the perspective taken by the ordo-liberals, the monetary order, that's my second point, functions as a complement to the free economic order. Therefore, the consideration of interdependence, first between the domestic economy and its markets, and second between the domestic economy and the international division of labor, was one of the central topics they discussed. As Peter Bernholz, who is teaching at the University of Basel, writes in an analysis of the great debates about which monetary constitution is compatible with a free society, it is not only the case in which the free and competitive formation of prices is a precondition for a sound and well-functioning monetary system, but that the reverse is also true. I quote, "All efforts to realize a competitive order are in vain as long as a certain stability of money has not been secured." The awareness of sound money's importance for the smooth functioning of markets developed in the first half of the 20th century out of the experiences of an open and of a repressed inflation in Germany. Both inflations were the results of the two world wars and their subsequent inadequate financing of public expenditures. Both inflations in Germany ended in monetary reforms in which the government debts were erased. Millions of citizens lost their savings and many experienced poverty. But the liberal economists did not only pay attention to the social problems caused by unstable money. Monetary instability was also a main concern for their scientific endeavors. They were aware of the fact that the monetary constitution greatly influences business activity. As far as their positive proposals were concerned, their ideal was money which could not be misused by governments to finance public debts through a monetary expansion. As Hans Wilgerodt stated, sound money is by definition an unpolitical money. Friedrich Lutz and others backed the proposition that the gold standard is the monetary constitution corresponding to a free market. But in the event this is not the feasible alternative, they favored monetary constitutions which minimized discretionary powers of those in charge of the money machine. They proposed plans for either 100% reserve requirement in central bank money for all demand deposits. This was a proposal by Lutz, or a commodity reserve currency with convertibility of money into a commodity bundle of fixed proportions at a fixed parity. Among them was great skepticism in the workability of the third best alternative, a modern central bank, independent of governmental instructions. Seen from here, the German preoccupation with the question whether the euro will be a stable money or not may be better understood. Of course, Germans know that they are criticized because of their so-called money stability madness, but they simply don't care about this critique. Their counter-argument is the harm caused by two inflations and monetary reforms in the 20th century. My third point is social policy. The point where the social market economy differs most from the elder conceptions of a free society is whether social questions should be on the agenda of the state. The German neoliberals, and their answer was resoundingly affirmative. They criticized their predecessors for not taking the socialist strictures against capitalism seriously as far as the question of social security are concerned. In a market economy, only those offering goods or services which are demanded by others can make a living. But in everyone's life, there are periods in which one cannot participate in the game of the market, be it childhood, unemployment, incapacity to work, sickness, or old age. In some cases, these everyday risks can be insured via the market, for instance, in private health insurance schemes. In other cases, these risks cannot be insured in the traditional way. Other non-market institutions are necessary to handle, for instance, cases of indigence and distress. And there was a long-lasting debate whether in such cases there was a duty of the state to intervene or to abstain from any social policy measures. According to the German neoliberals, some members of the old liberal school favored in principle that individuals should be responsible for making provision against all possible contingencies for themselves and their families, and that in cases where this did not work, relief should be left only to spontaneous private charity. Contrary to this view, the neoliberals argued that employment opportunities may shrink, personal disasters may occur in the form of accidents and ill health, old people and children may be the victims of other people's negligence, and in such cases, in many more, after two destructive wars and ruinous inflation, private charity could not be sufficient to prevent distress. Of course, the German liberals were aware of the indisputable fact that the necessary redistributive measures themselves might have a negative impact on the recipient's willingness to work and the taxpayer's readiness to create wealth. But, on the other hand, they were convinced that in a market economy, the strong incentives to produce would overcompensate the welfare losses caused by social policy. Additionally, the German liberals argued that men living in a free society would not be rational, egocentric wealth maximizers, as they are modeled in economic textbooks, especially in microeconomic textbooks, but that men are moral personalities, not opposing redistributive policies to prevent poverty. in Hayek's words, quote, "In the Western world, simple reason for those threatened by the extremes of indigence due to circumstances beyond their control has long been accepted as a duty of the community," unquote. But on what principle should a social order for the free society be built? Here the German liberals relied on the subsidiarity principle, in which state measures are only legitimate if private charities proves to be inadequate. After impoverishing wars, redistributive policies had to exist on a larger scale than in peacetime, with quickly growing wealth. But how should the normal risk of life, such as sickness, old age, and incapacity, be managed? There's a powerful externality argument for compulsory insurance. Otherwise, those who neglect to make provisions could become a burden to the public. Compulsory insurance does not automatically imply membership in a unitarian organization under state control, nor a national health service, for instance. An alternative is the creation of independent self-governing bodies. This evolves out of the liberal conviction that social questions of normal life risks are not primarily a duty of the state. At first glance, these independent bodies might appear to be a purely technical detail. But in the great debates on the foundation of a social state during the time of Bismarck, the old liberals fought for a state-free social insurance system. They rightly feared that a state-run national health service or state-run old age pension system would become an instrument for vote-maximizing political behavior. In the German case, they were successful only insofar as the German social security system is self-governing from a legal point of view, but unfortunately not from the political point of view. At this point, it should be stated that an important difference exists between the welfare state and the German conception of a social state. For instance, contrary to the British health service, which is run or was run by the state, the German system is built upon a club-like basis, such as health schemes for companies, corporations, communities, etc. In principle, these institutions are all autonomous. The members are elected by elect their representatives to the governing boards. And starting from the idea of a free society, it was self-evident that the autonomy of these bodies should be strengthened, thereby placing the social security system beyond the reach of politicians. Those insured in their respective clubs should be encouraged to control their administration to decide on the benefits they wish to insure for themselves and also fix the level of their contributions. A final remark on the influence of the social market economy program on German economic policy. My rather superficial sketch of West German's post-war liberalism leads to the difficult question of whether the social market economy program has impacted German economic policy during the last decades. Already in the early 70s, a member of the second generation of German order liberals, Hans Otto Lehnel, posed the question, does Germany still possess a social market economy? At that time, Karl Schiller, then Minister of Economic Affairs, represented his model of a so-called enlightened economic policy. According to this concept, conception, microeconomic relations should be under the control of competition via markets. Simultaneously, the macroeconomic relations should not follow the rules of the invisible hand. Instead, they should be steered with the assistance of non-compulsory planning for the entire economy by a so-called planification, or to use the German term, Globalsteuerung. The main instruments to reach such aims was a so-called concerted action, which the head of the unions and employers' associations gathered together, and where the Minister of Economic Affairs presented wage guidelines and informed both groups about future government plans, especially with respect to fiscal policy. From the standpoint of a social market economy, this represented an unacceptable interventionism, despite the fact that some of its leading members advocated business cycles policy under certain conditions, while criticizing at the same time Keynesian recipes for full employment as counterproductive. The macroeconomic policy of Carl Schiller, in which the ideas of John Maynard Keynes played a crucial role, failed under his successors and led in the mid-70s to Germany's first serious recession. Since the collapse of the Schmidt government in 1982 and the new coalition between Christian and liberal Democrats, the term social market economy has been used to describe official government policy. But whether this policy actually signals a self-commitment to the principles laid down by the founding fathers is a much debated question. Looking back on the period from 1948 to today of West German and now all German economic policy, it cannot be claimed that the economic policy of the country was simply the product of the social market economy program. Economists don't rule the world. But the important complement of the 1948 currency reform of the Western Allies was the scrapping of countless price regulation at one blow by Ludwig Erhard, and later a genuine institutional revolution which has led Germany on the path towards a market economy, and it is still on this path. Despite many interventions into the economic orders ordered since then, the growth of redistributional conditions, as Menko Olsen used to say, and many government measures against the market, it can be said that Germany is still a market-oriented country. In the years immediately following the end of the war, the possibility existed for another economic policy path. A good example is Great Britain, which, under the Fabian critique of capitalism, created a mild form of a welfare state together with full employment policy. Also, socialist experiments, perhaps not totalitarian but social democratic experiments, were pushed through in the years around 1948 by left-wing groups. That the path to a market economy was chosen was, according to my mind, the result of the courageous decision of Ludwig Erhard, who at that time maintained powers allowing him to act as a quasi-economic dictator. His decision was backed by the theories and conceptions of the order liberals and the proponents of a social market economy, and Erhard himself was a prominent member of that group. Erhard's path-breaking decision was not changed fundamentally since then. He introduced stepwise the rules of a market economy into a framework which under the Nazi government had been organized along the principles of economic planning. The ordo-liberal vision of a free society also sparked in my country a much deeper understanding of the problems of an economic order. For instance, a market order cannot be combined with all sorts of restraints on competition or collective property as the promoters of market socialism believe. The market system can only function smoothly under a system of private property rights and personal responsibility for decision makers. Therefore, privatization in a very broad sense is a constituting principle of a social market economy. But what happened in the three fields I mentioned before? The recommendation that competition policy is necessary to protect individual freedom led to a long discussion about the appropriate rules for the competition game. The outcome was the 1957 law against restraints of competition, which was a political compromise, as I mentioned before, and a Monopolies Commission Act. Now, the ordo-liberal view also entered Article 86 of the EC Treaty, and presently there's a sharp debate, especially with the French government, of how the economy should be run. The French view is still dominated by the mercantilist ideas going back to Colbert. The economy is looked upon as a part of the political system and therefore to be ruled by political decision taken somewhere in the political system. The ordo-liberals, on the contrary, favor a neutral, unpoliticized conception of an economy. A consequence of this view is that the economy is rather autonomous of the social system, and ideally, on its basic rule, its framework, and its agenda, that is only the part left for the state. The desirability of a stable money is undisputed in Germany. Free trade, free international trade, and unrestricted convertibility have strengthened the German marks, and the German mark is one of the three leading world currencies. Compared nearly to all other currencies, the German mark has preserved its value as the relatively most stable currency. And finally, in the field of social policy, here even the most optimistic German liberals are deeply dissatisfied. No use of the opportunity for an extension of personal freedom within the social institutions have been achieved. A reform in the old capital-funded pension system, which was promoted in 1957 to a pay-as-you-go system, gave Konrad Adenauer an unprecedented election victory through a 60% rise of old age benefits from one year to the next. Since then, the social policy is one of the main playing fields upon which political competition takes place. Today, according to my judgment, the whole social security system is the battlefield for income redistribution. The rapid decline in birth rates since the mid-60s questions the possibility of financing the system in the years to come. Of course, the state-controlled monopoly for old-age pensions is not the only possibility for financing benefits, and there are fierce debates as to which solution would better fit into the framework of a social market economy. Thank you for your attention.
We have time for one or two questions. If defense of the speaker completely down. Yes.
May I take this microphone?
Well, you are right. The economic situation in East German, in the new Länder, is not improving. We have had high growth rates in 1991 up to 1995. But now the growth rate in this part of Germany is down to 2%, maybe even less. We have many very, very serious problems in this part of Germany. To take a historical view, the former GDR, that is East Germany today, was a full-blown-up socialist system. Entrepreneurs even did not exist. Only a few handicrafts, about 12,000 shops, etc., were left private. And from one day of to the other, that means exactly on the 3rd of October 1990, the West German economic system was introduced there. And we expected that the same would happen, what we experienced in 1948 in West Germany, an outburst of economic activity, etc. But then everything went wrong. The first big problem were private property rights. To get investors into East Germany, the first condition was that they could buy ground where to build up a factory, etc. But there existed even no land registers, and it took more than 2 years to start the process of selling and buying property, estate. The second problem was how to settle the question of the exchange rate between the Ostmark and the Westmark. There was no market rate, but on average you could say that the implicit exchange rate which the communist government used was 4 East marks against 1 German mark. But then it was a political decision to convert the practically valueless East German money on a basis of 1-to-1 into the West mark. No communist would have dreamt that this could ever happen only 6 weeks before. Practically, this meant that the wages in East Germany increased in real terms tremendously from one day to the other, and that practically many German factories, which before that behind the veil of a trade monopoly could export cameras, etc., went bankrupt. The third thing which went wrong was the question how to deal with wages. The simple example given in political debates was the policeman in West and East Germany sitting in the same car, doing the same business, and the East policeman was paid only a quarter of the amount which was paid to the West German. And there started a movement to raise the wages in in East Germany to the same level, nominal level, as in West Germany within 4 to 5 years. And this is the situation we have now. This would not be a problem if the productivity in East Germany would be the same as in West Germany. But unfortunately, today, on average, the productivity of an East German worker is only 55% of his counterpart in West Germany. And if you would show us a way out of this problems, you could be very helpful for my country. Well, there's a colleague of mine here. Maybe he can say that I'm wrong or right. According to my impression, most academic economists in Germany would teach economics at universities or at other places are in favor for the market, not the market in the, let's say, laissez-faire teachings of the 19th century, but there's a generally mood in favor of the market. Second, I would say the German government is trying at least to give way to the globalization process by privatizing, for instance, telecom, what you did in this country, if I remember it correctly, 10 or 12 years ago, and also to privatize the railways and several other very big and very costly enterprises which we had before. On the other hand, the German government is a typical democratic government, and if there is hard pressure from the street, Kohl very quickly gives in. I think it is a shame to give for the next 7 years 70 billion German marks to a small group of miners, 85,000, to resettle coal mining in Germany and to bring down the production from, I don't know how many tons we are producing now, to, let's say, a quarter of that amount. This is, according to my mind, also destroying workplaces, because you have to take the money somewhere away, and you put it into an enterprise which is practically bankrupt. On the other hand, I also must say that there's a difficulty for strict reforms in the German political system. We have the Bundestag on the one hand, that's your parliament, and the upper house, the Bundesrat, on the other hand. And both institutions have to cooperate in lawmaking in very many cases. And the Kohl government has a small majority in the Bundestag, and the Social Democratic Party has an overwhelming majority in the Bundesrat. And that means, in the process of lawmaking, the Bundesrat can in many cases block initiatives which the government, the federal government, is taking. And there are very complicated and time-consuming rules how to settle such disputes. Finally, they are settled, but the outcome is normally that what the government really wants to do, it cannot do it without the consent of the opposition party. You can say in some respect you have a political system where two parties, the majority and the minority, are ruling together. The government tries, for instance, to reform the tax system. We have high marginal taxes, and every economist knows that this is not an incentive to produce and to be innovative, etc. But I'm afraid that the outcome will be a process where the whole idea is in the end diluted, and where the incentives which should come out of such a reform, you had one in your country a couple of years ago, that these incentives will be diluted. And therefore I would say we have a typical democratic system with the majority ruling. The majority has to convince people that what they are doing is good for them, but it's not very easy in a German situation, and it has to get it through a very complicated lawmaking machine. And this is really a very difficult situation.
Yeah. again, they did not put enough emphasis or any emphasis on the need for fiscal consolidation and barriers against growth, public expenditure, unfunded debt, and all the rest of it, which is linked to social security crisis. I wonder whether that's a fair comment or whether simply the politicians ignore what was said on the fiscal side.
Well, the fiscal constitution was not a problem at all for decades in Germany, despite the fact that we had compared to Great Britain, a more decentralized country. The fiscal constitution became a problem in Germany and during the last 10 years or so, when practically two German states were on the brink of bankruptcy. This is on the one hand the Saarland, and with only 1.5 million inhabitants, and on the other hand the Bremen, which is a city-state, an independent union among the 16 German states. According to a recent decision taken by the German Bundesverfassungsgericht, there is a duty of the richer lender to subsidize those who are bankrupt, and this is, of course, from an economic point of view, a shame, let me say it frankly. The fiscal constitution is also discussed as far as the European Monetary Union is concerned, but I do not want to discuss this subject. And in some respect, you can say that among the group of the German ordoliberals, there were only a few fiscal theorists and people who were interested in fiscal policy. And therefore, this was a weak part of the program. But on the other hand, the weakest part was and became the social policy. And I think the German system, you always are in a historic tradition when you start, that the German system with self-government of these bodies is a very good idea. And also an idea which I would say could function. But the situation as it developed politically was that the social security system got under the control of the politicians. And the central point was the pay-as-you-go system when it was introduced in 1957. As long as you have a capital-founded system, you can keep such a system apart from the political process. But if you have a pay-as-you-go system, that means a highly collectivistic system, then, of course, you need the help of the state, otherwise this cannot function. And I would say this is the Achilles heel of the conception, but Achilles died, but maybe the conception can be reformed.
It is, of course, always a puzzle to British commentators that the triumph of the Labour Party's socialist policy in 1979, was it, for the earnings-related pay-as-you-go pensions, was actually achieved by the Christian Democrats in 1957. A great mystery of the comparisons of the two countries. I think individual questioners can perhaps ask Professor Oettering further questions individually later, but we must, I think, now close. And I would like to thank Professor Oettering. It's been a fascinating and complex tour of intellectual history and of modern German social, political, and economic reality. We have learned a great deal. We're greatly in your debt. Thank you, Professor Oettering.